Chapter 33. Opening the Envelope.
My name is Nora. Today, I talk back to my mama, and I disrespect Miss Barbara who lives down the street. And my grandpa said he's going to teach me a lesson. My grandpa told me to write down everything he says, so that's what I'm doing. When I was a little boy, I lived in the cabin with my mama, my two brothers,
and my two sisters. Every day we had to work. It seemed like the only time we didn't do no work was in church on Sunday. Master Thomas was nice mostly, especially to mama. She used to say I looked just like him. The missus did not like that. She was always making us scrub the floor, even when we had done it the night before. You niggas are only good for working and singing, she always said. She was a wicked woman that treated the slaves real bad. One time I watched her tell Master Thomas that Zeke spilt a pail of feed. She made us all watch Big Jim the overseer beat him half to death with rakes and mallets, and then cut off his hand. They took a hot iron with a hook on the end and jammed it into his stump where his hand used to be. She said it was going to help him. He would never spill nothing else. My mama would sing for the master on Sundays. That's when she would let me sit with her and the other slaves that could play instruments. Charles played the piano in the house on Sunday, and Russell played the fiddle. Mama got Russell to teach me at night when we finished working. She told me they gonna learn you to play music so you don't never have to worry about getting beat or getting sold. You learn it good. When the master wanted music, I would play with Russell, Mama, and Charles. When Russell got sick, the master put him in the field. He worked him like a dog. When he couldn't work no more, they took him in the woods and tied him up and beat him. They made us watch while they put his shirt over his head and whipped him till his skin fell off. He screamed and screamed. Then we didn't hear Russell screaming no more. That's when Mama told me to keep playing that fiddle so what happened to Russell wouldn't happen to me. I used to play for the field workers at night before they went to bed. I played, and Mama sang. I learned to play the songs for the master when people come over and they had parties. One time, me and Mama went with Master Thomas and his wife to another house. They made us play for the masters there. I think his name was Master Ezra. Him and his wife liked how I played and how Mama sang. After the party, Master Ezra took my mama away that night. When it was time for us to go back the next morning, Mama was real sad. She didn't say nothing the whole way back. Mama was sad for a long time. She broke two of the missus' good teacups. The missus beat her and told Big Jim to take her outside with the horses. They made her plow the fields until she can't walk no more. I only saw her at night. She told me I had to keep playing. Leon, she said, as long as you got breath in you, you keep playing that fiddle. They won't do to you what they did to Malachi. He was my brother. He tried to run away. He didn't get far. When they catched him, they took him to the middle of the field and made him dig a great big hole. Then they made him put wood in it. Then they lit a fire. Big Jim made the other field slaves put shackles on his hands and ankles and spread them apart. Them men beat him with a horse whip, then cut off his foot and throwed it into that fire. Then they cut off his arm and throwed it into that fire. I will never forget how he screamed and how his skin burned and smelt. They kept cutting up his body and throwing it into the fire. They laughed at him screaming. When a slave looked away, they got beat. We had to watch Malachi be cut up and burnt as a lesson. I never saw somebody die like that. Mama told me, as long as I keep playing that fiddle, that would never happen to me. But I remember what happened to Russell when he got old and sick. I used to teach the youngins how to play at night after they finished working. Mama told me to help everybody I could, and that one day it would save us. I played for the master and his wife for years and years. Old Charles had died, and it was just me. I told the master that some of the field workers could play too. It would be good for us to play at his party in the evening. Every night I would go to teach the field slaves songs. Mama tried to sing, but she couldn't sing no more. Me and William and Betty and Abraham played for the master's party. There was a lot of people. Master Thomas said we did a fine job, and the next day he let me stop work at noon. Master Thomas always liked to have me around. He always wanted me to play. He treated me real fine. Sometimes he let me take food to my mama. Every day he made me play for him. He said it made him real happy. When his wife went to sleep, he made me play for him before he went in to sleep next to her. Master stopped coming out of the house after a while. He was getting sick. He would lay in his bed all day long. I always stayed with him and played while he was taking his medicine and having his treatments. He would lay in his bed and cry when I played. He said to me, "Leon, you let me know what the angels will sound like when I get there." I told him, "You ain't going nowhere, Master Thomas, sir." But he got sicker and sicker, and he smelled right bad. Not even the missus would go in to see him, but I was there every day. I played his favorite tune what seemed like 100 times a day. Then he started getting better. He got up and walked around sometimes. He was real slim. He would make me take my meals with him since the missus wouldn't see him no more. After 3 months, Master Thomas got so slim that he couldn't walk no more. I still sat with him and played every day. "I won't be here much longer, Leon," he say to me. So I say, "Where are you going, Master Thomas, sir?" I say to him. He just asked me to play him a tune. He say I made that fiddle sing like my mama used to. He told me how he loved to hear my mama sing. He said I was special. Then came a time when he told me, "Leon, you've been a good boy. You never tried to run away, and you do good work. What you want? Just tell me." I say, "Master Thomas, I want my mama to come back to the house." He told me, "I can't do that. My wife, the missus, won't have that." "Well then, I guess I want to be a free man." He say to me, "But if I free you, who will play for me at night?" I say to him, "I will play for you, Master Thomas, sir. I won't leave you. I will play for you as a free man." He thought about that, and he took out some paper, and he wrote out what he told me was my freedom papers, and he gave me them with my fiddle. I never let them papers out of my sight. Them paper and my fiddle kept me alive. I begged him on my hands and knees to let my mama be free too, and she would stay here and help him. He told me he couldn't do that. I went to tell mama that I was free.
I told her I was going to find work after Master Thomas passed, and that I was coming back for her to buy her freedom when I made enough money from my playing. You know what my mama told me? She told me, don't never come back to this place. You go be free, and don't you never look back. Master Thomas died in his bed. The missus made me play that song he loved. I left a few days later. The next year, I did come back to find Mama, but she was gone. You know why I told you all this and made you write it down? Because Master Thomas was a terrible man. He did terrible things to my mama and to my brother and to many other slaves. Even though he did all that, I still looked him in the eye and treated him with respect. No matter how mad I was, no matter how bad things got, I was always respectful. Even when I didn't get no respect. I don't never want you to forget that, girl. I won't never forget this. And I have learned my lesson. Signed, Nora Marks, age 9. Chapter 34. Day 48. Promenade. And with that final communication from Grandma Nora, Ray called Kim immediately, shared Jacob's documents with her. 2 days later, the attorney wrote that he was withdrawing the claim. Would Ray make the document public? It was very damaging to the Marks family, and of course none of this story could be verified. It might all be made up. Ray was disinclined to respond to their attorney. The Markses and their lawsuit fell away. He didn't feel triumphant, just vaguely uneasy. These white people wouldn't give up so quickly. They'd gotten it into their heads that the violin was theirs for their imaginary niece to play in her imaginary concerts, and there was no arguing with white people. So he didn't argue. He tried to forget them, let the press conjecture whatever it wanted. Ray wanted only to play. Ray and Nicole walked hand in hand along the Moskva River promenade. The sun was warm and glittered on the water. Nannies pushing prams trundled past, and people snacked on the benches. Ray grabbed Nicole and kissed her long and hard.
It's over.
She hugged him.
I'm so happy for you.
Oh my God, I am too, Ray said. I can't believe this monkey is finally off my back. Relief kept pouring off him. He'd take a breath, and he'd feel some unknown coil in his chest release and fall away. And then another breath, and another coil loosen and disappear. It was really over. It's like an angel is watching over me.
More like your grandmother.
Yeah, I was thinking that too. I always thought that she was with me. Always.
That letter she wrote. Do you think it's all true?
Yeah. I can't imagine a kid that age coming up with such graphic details. It's the horrible, ugly truth a lot of people refuse to even acknowledge. I don't know how people did it back then. They were treated worse than animals. I thought I had it bad with the comments people make, calling me a monkey or turning me into a PR stunt. It's nothing compared to what my family went through.
Try not to think about it, she said, rubbing his back. You know what? He said. I'm going to use it as a reminder of everything that my family has endured. When I get discouraged, I'm going to take that letter out and read it. Anything that I'm going through won't even compare to the things that used to happen. I wish I could go back and show this to people who told me I was being paranoid and melodramatic.
You should take this letter for what it is, Nicole said. Validation.
You're doing the right thing with your life. Your great-great-grandfather wasn't a thief. Your family has gone through some crazy stuff. Your grandmother has always been with you. Oh, and one more thing.
What?
Oh, nothing special. Just that this Ray is much nicer to be around than that super stressed out one.
Ray let out a belly laugh. Now comes the easy part. Traveling around the world as the Tchaikovsky competition silver medalist.
That'll be a breeze, she said. But at least you can get on with life without these crazy lawsuits.
You're right. He closed his eyes for a beat, smiled into the sunshine. The next few months are going to be crazy, he said after a while. They'd seen the schedule. The busy and interesting itinerary included touring China, Russia, France, Germany, and several other countries. The relief continued to pour off Ray, wave upon wave. He hadn't realized how much the Marx's craziness had depleted his mood.
You know, he said, I'm going to have to get a manager.
Several music management companies had reached out to him, and several record companies kept bugging him about a record deal, but he hadn't called any of them back yet. He felt it would be traitorous to perform without his own violin. Now that he was getting close to the $5 million ransom, it might be only a couple weeks until he had it back. Only $275,000 more to go.
You really should, she said. It's stupid for you to spend your time figuring out hotel bookings and car pickups. Managers charge 10%, right? I wonder if we should look into sharing a part-time personal assistant. It might be cheaper. She really was getting into this, and we could see who used him or her more, she said. If I used her more, I could pay more, or reimburse you, and vice versa.
You're really serious, Ray said, looking at her.
Yeah, why not? Someone to just help make life run more smoothly. Pick up dry cleaning and pick up groceries and schedule your trips and pick you up at the airport instead of taking an Uber. I wonder if they'd do laundry and get my car's oil changed.
She looked out across the river, said dreamily,
It really sounds kind of awesome. The question is, who pays for her time when she's sitting at the mechanics getting my oil changed? And she's booking your latest excursion to the Berlin Philharmonic.
You pay, he said. She's getting your oil changed.
Yeah, but it's your concert. She can schedule my concert after she's done with the oil change. I wish we could hire her today, Nicole said. I need to have my oil changed when I get back.
Didn't you just get one?
Yeah, but I'm almost 1,000 miles overdue. I'm going to have her keep track of that, too, when my car needs an oil change.
Nicole hated putting miles on her car. She loved public transportation and took it as often as possible.
1,000 miles? Good grief. Why do you drive so much? Don't act like you don't drive a lot.
Sure I do, but geez. Was this the last trip to Cleveland? She performed as a substitute for the Cleveland Orchestra a few weeks ago.
No, when I went to New York that time.
When did you drive back from New York?
When you were with Leonid at Juilliard, she said.
Remember, I drove?
Oh, yeah, he said.
Right. Something curled in the back of his head. A question mark. Anyway, he said after a moment, I really think we should think about the personal assistant thing. He searched on his phone.
Looks like they charge between $15 and $30 an hour. How many hours do you think you'd need?
Say, 10 hours a week, Nicole said.
If we each did 10, that would be $300 a week, or $15,000 a year. I think that's way cheaper than a management company. But is it worth spending $15,000 to pick up my dry cleaning?
Then again, if it's $15 an hour, it might be worth it. He wasn't listening anymore, thinking about her driving back to Erie from New York. She'd flown, not driven.
And then, it all made sense. Chapter 35. Day 56. Marcus Terry. Ray stood in Nicole's living room, staring blankly at a print over her living room sofa. Three cows in a field, a barn, and a few trees on the horizon. Where to start the search? She'd rented a house on Windview Place Road in Fairview, a quiet suburb of Erie, a couple miles from the lake. Being so close to Lake Erie made the properties in the area highly sought after. The family of a wealthy orchestra patron actually owned the house. The only reason that Nicole could afford it was that the patron had died, and the family had offered to rent the house to one of the symphony musicians for a couple years while the patron's will worked its way through probate. The house was big for one person. Two levels, three bedrooms, a yard that Nicole would mow, complaining, with a push mower once a week. She wasn't much of a homemaker. Erie was clearly just a stepping stone to bigger orchestras and bigger cities, but she kept the house clean and neat. He'd called Alicia the moment the plane had touched down at JFK and the seatbelt sign had gone off. "I know where it is," he told her. It was 3 days after the conversation at the Moskva. Janice and Nicole had returned together to the United States the day after. Ray was supposed to be in Moscow to begin the Tchaikovsky competition tour. Instead, he'd taken a flight to America a day later, after they'd both left. He hadn't said anything to either Janice or Nicole. He didn't want to arouse any suspicion, especially if he was wrong. He was desperate to tell Janice, but she was traveling with Nicole. It was too risky. Now that he was back in the United States, he called Alicia, who was still in Europe tracking down leads to other violins which Ray now knew were not his strad. "What do you mean?" Alicia asked him. "How? Where is it? Where are you?" "Nicole has it. Just landed at JFK.
"What? Where is this coming from?"
"She said she drove."
"What?"
"She drove. She said she drove back to Erie, from New York. She didn't fly out of Newark like she said. She drove."
"Hold on," Alicia had said. "Let me get my notes."
Computer keys tapping.
"You know, of course, that she had the most access of anyone, so we've been looking at her the hardest."
"Still?"
"Yep. Following her credit card bills, phone calls. Nothing. No unusual charges. Nothing out of the ordinary. Hold on, here it is. No, she flew. She definitely flew from Newark to Erie. I have confirmation from the airlines. Plus, we have surveillance footage of her in the airport. And the X-ray footage of her suitcases going through the scanner."
"That doesn't make sense," he'd said. "She told me that she drove from New York."
"It must have been some other time," Alicia had said. "There was no other time. She hates to drive her car as it is. She was complaining about needing an oil change. She said that she was putting too many miles on her car after the trip from New York. She has never driven to New York since I've known her. Never. She never drives anywhere if she can help it. She takes public transportation. She's like the queen of public transportation. She knows every bus route from here to New York. You should hear about the complicated way she gets from Manhattan to Newark Airport to save $4. I can't possibly get a warrant to search her house based on a drive back from New York." It was hard to hear her over the noise of the plane, people talking loudly and the thrum of the engines. Then the engine started powering down. "There's no other explanation," he'd said. "She has to have it. She drove back with it to Erie, which is why it didn't get flagged in the airport. It must have been in one of her suitcases. She had two. I remember really clearly that she had two. I'm going to confront her. I'll wear a wire. I'll get it on tape."
"You will do nothing of the kind," Alicia told him. "If she doesn't have it, you won't get anywhere. If she does have it, you'll tip her off."
"How am I going to get it back then?"
Don't do anything rash, you hear me? I know you're upset, but upset? Are you fucking kidding me?
His voice was getting louder. His seatmate was staring at him. He ducked, whispered into the phone.
My girlfriend stole my violin, and you don't want me to be upset?
Look, I hear you. I'm still in Belgrade. Let me get back and we can regroup. I'll put the art team and the FBI on it in the meantime. And I'll dig in from here. I can get a flight out tomorrow. It's waited this long, it can wait a little bit longer. Let me think it through.
Great idea, he said. Can you get a warrant in the meantime?
There's not enough for a warrant, she repeated. Yet.
Around him, the other passengers were standing, grabbing luggage, moving down the aisle. He seized the violin case.
Okay, I'm heading to Erie now. I'll wait for you there.
Don't you dare, she said. Just stay where you are and don't do anything to tip her off. If she has it, she's hidden it for this long. Don't blow it. Just go back to Charlotte like you planned.
Okay, he said. I gotta go. And hung up.
10 minutes later, in the customs line, he thumbed through his Delta Airlines app. Yes, there was a flight to Erie in 2 hours. He could make it. That had been 4 hours ago. Now he stood in Nicole's living room, staring at her living room walls. Where to start? Over the past year, he'd spent days here, weeks, often alone. Was the violin here all along in a closet? In her basement? In the attic? How could he search now without giving himself away? How could he have been so close? 6 p.m. He timed his arrival after she'd left for rehearsal at the symphony. The Erie Philharmonic had a major performance in a few weeks, which meant that the earliest she'd be back was 10:15, 10:30. Unless they let out early, which they also might do. He had 4 hours. He thought back to those days at Grandma Nora's, hunting for Pop-Pop's fiddle in the attic. He'd started by randomly looking in boxes, opening drawers, but soon enough became systematic, proceeding stack by stack, box by box, no matter how unlikely a hiding place. In the end, his system hadn't worked. Who knew where Grandma Nora had hidden it all that time? She'd just beamed at him and never told him. But perhaps this time, the system would hold him in good stead. He'd begin in the attic. If there was an attic, he didn't know, and he sure hoped she wasn't hiding his violin in an attic with widely fluctuating temperatures, and work downward. He'd look for anything. A violin-sized box, keys to a storage unit, any kind of reference that might seem like a lead. He'd look for hiding places in the drywall, loose floorboards. He'd seen enough movies to know the drill. He couldn't imagine her giving the violin to her parents or to a friend for safekeeping. She'd want as few people to know about it as possible. The attic was a tiny crawl space off the upstairs bathroom. Nothing in it. Room by room he searched, pulling out every drawer, checking for false bottoms, for loose moldings on walls. Halfway through the upstairs, thank goodness the house wasn't that big, he texted Alicia again. Did she rent a safe deposit box? He waited. No response. It was after 2 a.m. in Belgrade. She must have been asleep. Nothing in Nicole's closet apart from what should be. He shook out each shoe in every shoebox, opened every piece of luggage, checked behind every picture, lifted up the mattress, remade the bed. He'd finished the upstairs, the master bedroom and the spare room she used as a practice room, when Alicia texted back, clearly not asleep.
No, that was the first place we looked. Also, no storage unit. I'll see you tomorrow. Wait for me.
Ray, did you check her mom and sister? How about Tina Reed?
Nicole was close to her mother and sister, who lived outside Harrisburg, and Tina was her best friend at the orchestra.
Alicia,
we asked for all this information from her right after the theft. We've checked them all. I've already contacted Bill Soames to ask him to run a check on everyone again. More tomorrow. Down the stairs, checking each stair tread. The house was newish, built during the 1980s steel boom, with cheap hollow core doors and wall-to-wall Berber carpet. There didn't seem to be any structural hiding places. He often stayed over, so she would of course know that he'd be in the house. Wherever she hid it, it had to be somewhere he wouldn't normally go. The basement? The unheated garage out back? It was nearly 8 p.m. when he made a peanut butter sandwich, ate it standing at the sink, staring down at an unwashed coffee mug. She'd be back in a couple hours. I missed you, so just flew in to see you, he imagined telling her, trying out the words. Could he sound sincere? On the main level sprawled the kitchen, dining room, living room, half-bath slash laundry room, foyer. The living room was immaculate. The gray couch sat quietly, yellow pillows staring back at him. The rubber tree plant was shiny and tall, not a speck of dust on our dark hardwood floors. On the console in the foyer, a pile of mail was neatly stacked. He thumbed through it, as if expecting a postcard from the violin. Hi, hope you're well. Really enjoying my time here in the front closet. Wish you were here. This was stupid. What had he been thinking? Nicole loved him. She listened to all his family drama. She was there with him when only Aunt Rochelle would speak to him. You can do this, she would tell him, grabbing his face with both her hands. You're better than they let you know. She'd pull him close, their foreheads almost touching. And everyone you meet is better because of you. But why had she driven back from New York? The hall closet was packed with winter coats. He went through every pocket. Besides the basement, all that was left were the half-bath slash laundry room, the dining room, and the kitchen. He dreaded the kitchen, fishing around in the flour, emptying the open boxes of pasta, pouring out the bag of rice, so figured he'd start with the bathroom. Nothing in the powdered laundry soap. Nothing in the cabinets. Nothing taped to the back of the toilet or suspended in the toilet tank the way he heard drug dealers hid their stash. He sat on the toilet and thumbed through the pile of magazines on the shelf next to him. He'd seen them all before, but he was being thorough, right? There were those old men's health magazines, which were still arriving addressed to Marcus Terry, the previous tenant, whose subscription had still not run out. Who's Marcus Terry? He'd once asked Nicole when they'd started dating. I think that's the guy who used to live here. He remembered her telling him that the house had sat empty for several months as the heirs tried to decide what to do with it. The patron's estate was complicated, and probate was going to take years, which is why they finally agreed to rent it to a symphony musician. That conversation with Nicole had been 6 months ago, and she'd moved into the house more than a year ago. This men's health issue was from July of this year. The subscription should have run out by now, shouldn't it? What was the name of the orchestra patron who died? He Googled the address. Elizabeth Sutton, beloved wife of Benjamin, and mother of James and William, passed away on. No Marcus Terry. Nicole had been the first tenant in the house. He remembered that very clearly. Perhaps Elizabeth Sutton had had a caregiver, though. No mention of his name in the obituary. Another Google search. Marcus Terry's new address was 3822 Bremer Street, a 15-minute drive away. He texted Alicia. Can you track down a Marcus Terry, 3822 Bremer Street? No response. She must be asleep. It was 9 p.m. He had perhaps another hour before Nicole returned. Marcus Terry intrigued him, but he had only a short while to keep searching the house. He spent the next hour going through the kitchen. He searched the refrigerator and the cabinets over the stove, with only the lower cabinets, dining room, and basement left, and then called it quits for the night. Let himself out. He'd finish tomorrow. In the meantime, he'd drive over to Bremer Street. Under the streetlights, Marcus Terry's house was in shadow. An ancient Honda Civic, bumper askew, rusted in front of the garage. A light glowed dim from inside the house. Finally, he drove off to check in at the Holiday Inn off the interstate. Although he was beyond exhausted, his body was still operating on European time. He couldn't sleep. What was Marcus Terry's connection to Nicole? A Google search of Marcus Terry turned up a handsome, worked-out man in his early 30s. His dark brown hair hung to his shoulders, framing a square face with very thick eyebrows and a thin mustache. His nose looked like it had been broken a few times. He looked vaguely familiar. What if Nicole had already gotten rid of the violin? Morning couldn't come soon enough. When he awoke, dazed and disoriented at 3 a.m., 9 a.m. Moscow time, multiple texts from Alicia awaited him. How had he not heard the phone chime? Alicia, Marcus Terry is personal trainer at Gold's Gym, West Erie, 34. $15,542 in credit card debt. Been renting 3822 Bremer since last October. Previous address, 184 Winview Place. Where are you? Alicia, I've alerted Bill Soames, who will be contacting you momentarily. Flight BEGEWR arriving 11 a.m. Do not do anything stupid. I will call you when I land. Marcus Terry's previous address, as Nicole had told him, was 184 Winview Place. What she hadn't told him was that he'd been living there with her in October when Ray and Nicole first met. Marcus Terry had moved out shortly after Ray had met her. Why had nobody ever mentioned him to Ray? Not Nicole or Tina or any of their other friends. He didn't answer Alicia's texts. At the all-night Walmart where he'd often shopped with Nicole, he bought a cheap t-shirt and a package of disposable rubber gloves. Then he drove back to 3822 Bremer. Summer dawn came early, just after 5 o'clock, illuminating a beat-up house behind an unkempt lawn. The mailbox hung crookedly from the side of the front door. The other houses nearby were equally rough. Two doors down, a car sat on blocks in the driveway. He parked across the street, several driveways away. What time did personal trainers go to work? 9 o'clock? Didn't a lot of people work out before heading to their jobs in the morning? Gold's Gym opened at 5:30. At 5:10 a.m., a light flicked on. Good thing Ray had arrived early. A figure passed the living room window, and Ray involuntarily ducked down, then laughed at himself. But he stayed low in the seat, waiting. At 5:23, Marcus Terry opened the front door and got into his Honda Civic. Ray barely caught a glimpse. He put on the rubber gloves, stuffed a bunch more in his pocket just in case. As soon as Marcus Terry's car turned the corner, Ray was out in the pre-dawn silver light, walking quickly. Was going to jail for breaking and entering worth getting his violin back? Hell yes, it was. A chain-link fence ran around the back of the house. Was there a dog? He didn't hear one. He opened the gate, slipped through, wincing as the metal shrieked. A passing car made him move even more quickly. The back door was locked and visible from the houses behind it. A big oak tree partially blocked the view, but not well enough. No lights in any of the neighbors' windows. He found a rock in a weed-filled garden bed next to the house. He pulled out the Walmart t-shirt, wrapped the rock in it to muffle the noise, and, with a single tap, broke the window above the doorknob. No going back now. He reached in, unlocked the door from inside, closed the door behind him. Silence. Only then did he wonder if Marcus Terry had a roommate or a live-in girlfriend. But there had been only one car in the driveway, unless another hid in the attached garage. He waited, unmoving, peering out the window to see if anyone had noticed him. Nothing. He set the shirt and the rock down just inside the door, went quickly through the house. He was alone. The place was a wreck. Clothes and bags were strewn all over the couch, a full ashtray on the coffee table. A Tony's pizza box full of crusts lay open on the floor. Marcus Terry, a personal trainer, sure did a great job with fueling the temple of his body. A sink full of dishes. On the kitchen table, a half gallon of milk that should have been in the refrigerator sat next to a box of Fruity Pebbles. Marcus Terry had left the milk out. Did that mean he'd be back soon? Ray called Gold's Gym. Hi, can you tell me when Marcus will be done? Does he have a lot of appointments today? The receptionist checked. He had 4 appointments and was done at 9:30. Could she schedule him a session? What was Ray's name? Ray would text Marcus later. Thanks. He had, at the most, 4 hours, unless an appointment canceled. In the front hall closet were several boxes of random papers. He scanned them as quickly as possible. Tax returns, copies of old bills. In the bedroom, under the bed, were boxes of winter clothes and boots. As he moved to the bedroom closet, his phone buzzed. Alicia. He ignored it. What time did she leave Belgrade again? Had she already returned to the U.S.? 6:45. Back to the kitchen. On the far left corner of the fridge, beneath a coupon for protein powder and hanging awry, was a photo of a shirtless Marcus Terry hugging a young woman with auburn hair and a single music note tattooed above her wrist. Nicole. Somehow, despite all this, Ray somehow hadn't believed it. Through the kitchen cabinets, emptying cans and boxes of food onto the floor, then adding mismatched cups and plates. Nothing. Was there an attic? A basement? In the cabinet next to the back door, inches from where he'd left the shirt-wrapped rock, he found a cardboard box packed with more old mail. Flyers from moving companies, old gas and electric bills, and a tan, oversized clasp envelope stuffed with invoices from Lowry Storage. There were 3 invoices dating from this past May to July. At the bottom of the envelope were 2 identical small silver keys. A storage unit, rented on May 12th. On May 16th, his violin had been stolen. His phone rang again. Bill Soames this time. He hit Do Not Disturb. By then it was 7:30 and the neighborhood was coming to life. He decided to get out. A black man coming out of Marcus Terry's home would no doubt raise eyebrows. Ray wasn't going to take the chance that a neighbor would report him. He'd fill in Alicia and Bill Soames. They'd get a warrant. They'd figure this out. Among the detritus on the living room floor, he found a ratty, eerie Seawolves baseball cap, tucked it low across his eyebrows. He stuffed the manila envelope under his shirt and, carrying the shirt-wrapped rock, unlocked Marcus Terry's front door, removed the rubber gloves, and casually sauntered over to his car, waiting for a, "Hey, you!" from the neighbors. No one seemed to notice him. He unlocked the rental and drove off. A block away, he wrapped the shirt, rock, cap, and gloves in the plastic Walmart shopping bag, tossed it off the bridge into the Trout Run stream below. He called Alicia. Her voicemail picked up. By now, she would be on a plane heading back to the United States. "Hi. I went to Marcus Terry's house. She knows him. I think they're working together. I found a bunch of receipts and a key to a storage unit in Erie. Lowry Storage. I'm heading there now. He hung up. He should call Bill Soames back. Soames would have to fly in, unless he called in some local field agents, which is surely what he'd do. But would they have to get a warrant? Did they have probable cause? Ray had broken into and entered Marcus Terry's house. Would that make getting a warrant more difficult? Plus, when Marcus Terry got home after 9:30, he'd see that someone had smashed the glass in his back door. How long would it take until he noticed that the envelope was missing? It was already 8:45. Lowry Storage, open 24 hours, was 4.3 miles away. He would reach his destination in 7 minutes if traffic was light. He pulled into the parking lot of a big gated building with rows of unheated storage units out back. There was a code to get in the back gate. He didn't have it. He went through the manila envelope. Didn't see a code. In the office, a short burly man with thinning black hair and glasses looked up when the sliding doors opened and Ray came in. His one earring was an iron cross. He had a tattoo of a koi fish on his hairy forearm.
Huh? Can I help you?
Hi. Yes, I'm in Unit 601, and I don't remember the code to get in.
Okay. Let's see what we can do. Name?
Marcus Terry.
I got you right here, Mr. Terry. I'll just need to see some ID.
I actually ran out of my house without my wallet.
Sorry. I can't give you the code without any ID.
Come on, man. Give me a break, please. It's already turning out to be a shitty day. My address is 3822 Bremer Street. My grass needs cutting. My old lady is all up my ass. I'm almost out of gas, and I need to go grocery shopping. What else do you want to know? My shoe size? 10.5. Here are the keys, see? And here's an invoice. The burly man behind the counter smiled sympathetically.
I hear you, bud. I've had those days. Give me a sec. Here, I'll write it down for you.
Ray watched him scrawl the code on a slip of paper. Thanks, man. You've literally saved my life. He shook the man's hand, turned to go.
Excuse me, Mr. Terry?
Ray froze.
Yeah? This month's payment is 2 weeks past due.
Oh, okay. Let me talk to the old lady and have her give you a credit card. He headed out toward the storage units. This is probably the last month I'll be using it anyway.
Hey, where are you going? The man asked.
Ray froze again.
I thought you said you were 601.
Ray didn't move.
That's in here, remember? That's one of the climate-controlled lockers.
Ray shook his head. Laughed. Yeah, duh, sorry. I don't know where my head is today. He turned right, toward the interior of the building, and the door slid shut. He punched in the code. The security door opened. He followed the signs to 601, about halfway down a long hallway lined with dozens of blue corrugated metal doors. Above him, a fan clicked on. A few rows over, someone rattled something, and then came the sound of glass clinking on cement. The locker couldn't be that large. Doors about 3 feet wide marched endlessly side by side down the corridor. There was 601. He fumbled in his pocket for the keys. His fingers shook. His hands were sweating, and he had to try 3 times to get the key in the metal padlock. Finally, the key slid in, clicked, and the shackle slipped back. He removed the lock, placed it on the ground, pulled back the bolt, and lifted the corrugated metal door. The unit was shallow, maybe 3 or 4 feet deep, with a cement floor. It was completely empty, except for a medium-sized cardboard box from Amazon taped closed. He ripped away the tape. Inside was a cheap black plastic laminate violin case. He opened it. Pop Pop's fiddle. His own most loved Stradivarius violin. Grinned up at him. Unharmed. Perfect. Chapter 36. Aftermath. In the months leading up to the trial, it all came out, and it was so very simple. The morning of the theft, while Ray was showering, Nicole put on a pair of gloves, took out the violin, and stashed it in her small roller bag, using her clothes to pad it. In its place, she left the Chuck Taylor shoe and the ransom note. She'd bought the shoe at a Walmart outside Cleveland. Ray, oblivious, followed her out the door and down to the lobby, slung her roller bags into her taxi, and kissed her goodbye. The taxi took her to Penn Station, as the GPS and the driver's own testimony corroborated. She exited the taxi, went down to the bowels of Penn Station, her route confirmed by dozens of video cameras along the way. She'd already bought her ticket on New Jersey Transit to Newark Airport, which she charged to her Visa. She stayed on the train one station past Newark Airport, got off at Elizabeth Station wearing a baseball cap. Detectives later found the video footage, went across the street to where she'd parked her car in an overnight parking garage. She took out the violin, slipped it in a cheap plastic case that she'd picked up at a pawn shop, slid the case on the back seat floor, and covered it casually with a towel. Then, after locking the car, she caught the next train back to Newark Airport. She'd missed her stop, she told the conductor, waving her Newark ticket. She'd flown back to Erie, and then that night when Ray alerted her to the theft, flew back to New York. When they finally left New York, she picked up her car and drove back to Erie with the violin in her back seat. None of the detectives thought of checking her last route from New York back home. The extra miles meant an earlier oil change. Gosh, she hated driving her car. If only she'd taken public transportation. Pilar Jimenez, who delivered their breakfast that morning, was a particular bit of brilliance. Nicole had learned months ago that many of the San Jacques housekeeping staff had emigrated illegally. The day before the theft, Nicole had paid the housekeeper $5,000 to deliver the breakfast cart and return to Honduras. If the woman refused, Nicole would report her to U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The woman took the money and went back to Honduras, a nice red herring to keep the detectives busy. Back in Erie, Nicole met up with Marcus Terry, who'd already rented the storage locker, and he took the violin in a cardboard box to the unit. Marcus Terry, her boyfriend. They'd supposedly had a terrible breakup. Marcus was out of her life, and she used a burner phone to communicate with him. Otherwise, they stayed apart in case detectives were watching her. He'd been in on the theft from the beginning. Ray's whole relationship with Nicole was based on her lies. She'd seen an opportunity when she'd met a lonely violinist with a priceless violin, and she'd taken it. In prison, awaiting trial, Nicole reached out several times to Ray. She called, texted, emailed. He wouldn't respond. He wondered if the only reason she wanted to see him was for him to plead with the prosecutors for leniency. He imagined her telling him that Marcus Terry had dreamed up the whole idea, that she went along with it only because Marcus Terry had some diabolical hold over her. Marcus Terry, criminal mastermind and fruity pebbles connoisseur. And then she'd email. He'd deleted several earlier ones, but this email he opened. Dear Ray, are you getting any of my emails? I know that saying sorry doesn't ease your pain. I never wanted to hurt you. I know you won't believe me, but it's true. My idea was that nobody would get hurt. Everybody wins. If Benson paid out the ransom right away like it was supposed to,
you would have gotten your violin back before the competition. If they didn't pay it out, you raised the money anyway. In any case, you'd get your violin back, and I get a nest egg so I don't have to worry so much about making ends meet. Not everybody has your talent, and you know I didn't want to stay in a third-rate orchestra all my life. A little more money would have gone a long way. I could have bought a new viola and taken lessons with Caitlin Landite. You know how I always wanted to do that. It would have given me a shot, the same shot you had. You can't blame me for wanting the same opportunity you had. It's not my fault. It's Benson's. Anyway, I wanted to write you because I didn't want you to be mad. I love you very much, and I just want you to be happy. I just wanted to be happy, too. Please come see me and we can talk about this in person. I really want to see you and talk face to face. Love, Nicole. Ray didn't respond and didn't open any of the other dozen emails she sent him in the following couple weeks before he asked the prosecutors to make sure she couldn't contact him again. The trial took more than a year, and Ray videoed in his testimony from Sweden, where he'd been playing with the Royal Stockholm Philharmonic Orchestra before heading off to a special month-long recital and retreat in Tokyo. He couldn't forget her. He'd wanted so many times to talk to her, to ask her how she could have done this, how she could have done this to him. He thought they were in love. He thought they shared intimacy and a real connection. Was any of it real? Was it all and always about the violin and the money? Dear Ray, I'm sorry for everything I put you through. I want you to know that. I really care for you, and you need to know your violin was never in any danger. I would have gotten it back to you no matter what. It was all Marcus's idea. I just went along because he told me to. Please believe me. The sentencing is coming up next week, and it would mean everything to me if you'd just testify on my behalf. Ask the judge for leniency. Please do it. You mean everything to me. I really screwed up, and I'm more sorry than you could ever know. Please? Love, Nicole.
By the time her sentencing rolled around, Ray was back in the United States, playing at a special sold-out exhibition at Berkeley. As Nicole had asked, he wrote a letter to the judge. Dear Judge Kastenmeier, Nicole Sellen spent 9 months lying and deceiving me. She pretended to love and support me, all while planning to steal my violin. She almost got away with it. She is heartless and manipulative. She wrote me a couple weeks ago asking for leniency. She planned on cheating me and thousands of other people out of millions of dollars. She stole a violin that meant more to me than all the money in the world. Feel free to give her the maximum sentence. Sincerely, Ray McMillan. Both Nicole and Marcus Terry ended up going to jail. 8 years and a $1.8 million fine for Nicole, and 5 years and $950,000 fine for Marcus Terry. Nicole's orchestral career was over. She would be lucky to play in a community orchestra. Ray sometimes wondered what she would do when she got out of prison, but tried not to think about her too much. In the meantime, Ray was playing all over the world. As the violin silver medalist with the Tchaikovsky competition, great stuff happened. After the first year of traveling internationally, he rediscovered his love of chamber music and formed his own group, the Besk Quartet. They traveled all over the United States, South America, and in Europe. Their performances of Schubert, Mozart, Haydn, Shostakovich, Dvorak, and Brahms garnered them dozens of awards and accolades from every major classical music institution. He recorded for Sony, Naxos, and BMI, and his quartet did the same. Ray made it a point to highlight music by Black and Latinx composers. After all those years fighting and proving wrong the preconceptions that people who looked like him couldn't play the music of dead European white men, he dove into the phenomenal music written by those people who indeed did look like him. William Grant Still was his favorite, and Ray popularized his Suite for Violin and Piano, Josephine Reed's Yellow coming a close second, and Florence Price's Second Violin Concerto, rounding out the top three. Whenever he performed any of these pieces, someone would invariably come up to him and tell him how amazing that piece of music was, as if Ray didn't know. "I'd never heard of her until I heard you play that," the audience member would say. And Ray's reaction was always the same. "You're welcome." He said it with a smile, and meant it. He was a celebrity, and he never got used to it. Whenever he returned to New York and played at Birdland, the crowd stretched down the block. He made guest appearances in musicals on Broadway and concertos in Carnegie Hall, soloed with the best orchestras on the planet, and dated a supermodel for a while. Ray was living a life he never thought he would have. Once, years later, on the phone with his mother, he asked her if she was still mad at him for not getting that high school job at Popeyes, for not getting his GED, and not going to work at the cafeteria hospital with Ricky. She told him that she didn't know what he was talking about, and he should stop this foolishness. Secretly, Ray was a rotten celebrity. He never got used to it, never learned to take it for granted. The photos and adulation and program signing always made him uncomfortable. And after the theft, he never ordered room service again. Every day, no matter where he was, he'd find a busker or someone on the street and leave money or help otherwise when he could. He was making a great deal of money and giving a lot of it away as quickly as he got it. He played charity concerts for several different organizations. He loved Kelly Hall Tompkins's Music Kitchen, a charity that organized musicians to serve food and play in soup kitchens, and he often volunteered both to play and to serve the guests. Another charity bought instruments for students who couldn't afford to buy their own. At the inaugural fundraising gala he played for free, enlisted several musicians, Wynton Marsalis and Trombone Shorty, and donated $100,000 to the cause. Every day, Ray's routine was the same. As soon as he woke, he'd open the Tonarelli case to ensure that his violin, Pop Pop's violin, was nestled inside. Every day it would shine up at him, safe, and his heart would swell in his chest. Many times he'd flash back to that Christmas long ago, and the memory of opening an alligator skin case with a loose handle, and he'd breathe in the aroma of mildew, old wood, and good luck dust. Every night before he went to bed, he'd stash the violin case within easy reach. As he fell asleep, he'd think about the day's events and remember his grandmother's Thanksgiving words to him, seasoned with love, potato peels, and sliced squash, that he worked twice as hard as everyone else, that he stand tall and treat others with respect, and that he stay the same sweet Ray that Grandma Nora loved so much. He didn't know if he'd succeeded, but he never stopped trying. He had to believe that she would be proud.
Epilogue.
That October seemed especially chilly. but maybe it was just the wind creeping between his pants and his socks. He sat on the park bench and breathed deep, admired the red maple across the street, its leaves lit seemingly from within, burning with the end of summer. It made him realize how beautiful everything around him truly was. "I have to leave a little early if I'm going to make it to Bryce's recital tonight," he said to Janice. "I think maybe I'll start Remy on the Bach A minor concerto. If he gets it down, then Verno should be no problem for him to pick up."
"You still love that piece, don't you?"
"Yeah, it's always been my favorite. I wish I'd performed it more."
"Why don't you perform it next time?"
"Nah, people want to hear more flashy concertos." Across the street, the steel and glass of the Community Arts Center in Charlotte was the envy of North Carolina for its state-of-the-art performance theater and its multiple practice spaces. Ray had spearheaded its creation 3 years ago and still loved looking at it.
"Who cares what they want?" she said. "It's what you want, remember?"
"Yeah," he said. "I remember. I play because I love it."
"That's right."
"Funny. It seems like a million years later, and you're still telling me what I already know."
"No, just a gentle reminder."
Half a block away, a boy was dragging his mother by the hand. Their voices echoed up to him, ghostly in the afternoon light.
"Hurry up," he was telling her. "I need to practice before my lesson."
Ray smiled at them both, but neither noticed him.
"Remind you of anyone?"
Janice shifted on the bench.
"No, not at all. I was much taller when I was his age."
"True. And I think he's more dedicated," she said.
"I keep meaning to tell you something, and it always slips my mind. I wonder why that happens."
"Old age," she said.
"First the memory goes, then the bladder, and then it's all downhill."
"You made this all possible." Ray reached out to the maple tree, to the afternoon sun slanting down, to the building glowing with promise, to the kid and his mom nearly on top of them.
"Your belief in me."
"I just encouraged what was already there," she said. "I could tell from the first time I saw you at that school rental how in love with music you were, despite nobody being there to help. It was inside you. Now you can give it to others. Courage and hope."
"You did. You gave it to me."
"What a gift."
"Music's the gift. Caring's the gift. And you give it to others now. There are a lot of ways apart from a concert hall to make a difference in someone's life."
As the kid and his mom approached, the little boy broke away and sat down beside Ray.
"Mr. Mack," he said, looking up, "I can play the whole sonata now. I practiced every day, didn't I, Mom?"
"He did," she said, walking over to them. "DeMarcus never missed a day. I don't know what you told him, but it worked."
"That's fantastic. Why don't we go in a few minutes early so you can show me what you can do?"
"Yes, sir."
Ray, DeMarcus, and his mom crossed the street together. As Ray held the door for them, he looked back at the sunlight pouring like music over an empty park bench.
"Hey."
"Thanks, Janice."
Author's note. This is Brendan Slocum, author of The Violin Conspiracy. Music is for everyone. It's not, or at least shouldn't be, an elitist, aristocratic club that you need a membership card to appreciate. It's a language. It's a means of connecting us that is beyond color, beyond race, beyond the shape of your face or the size of your stock portfolio. Musicians of color, however, are severely underrepresented in the classical music world. That's one of the reasons I wanted to write this book. Look up the statistics. 1.8% of musicians performing in classical symphonies are black. 12% are people of color. But for me, day to day, performance by performance, it wasn't about being a statistic. It was about trying to live my life and play the music that I loved, and often being stymied for reasons that seem, even now, incomprehensible. Many of the events in this novel, the wedding scene, the Baton Rouge shakedown, the auditions, come from my own life experiences. Having someone look at you with hatred just because your skin is a different shade from theirs is a devastating feeling that I'd never wish upon anyone. When I share these stories with friends who don't look like me, I get the same reaction. Things like that don't happen. It's not really like that. They do. It is. In order to make sense of this chaotic and often perplexing world, we get caught up in trying to shove people into categories. Who can or who can't. Who should and who shouldn't. I, as well as other people who look like me, have often been placed into the can't or shouldn't category. Only through sheer will and determination can we defy the standards that others have set for us. As a black violinist, I have had to work twice as hard as my non-black counterparts to receive the same benefits. In college, I always had to prove myself and wasn't always successful. I dealt with very real racism, discrimination, and stereotyping from professors, other musicians, and the audience. In a music history class, my professor told us that black people played Chopin better than white people because of the embedded jungle rhythms in our blood. I was passed over not because I was incapable, but because I was perceived as incapable. Struggle became a normal part of life. At weddings and receptions, I often couldn't be the face of my string quartet because blacks aren't as good at this. I was automatically an oddity, rarely seen, whose talents were almost never recognized. How are you doing that? I had no idea you would be so good. You really surprised me. I've been fortunate enough to be a guest conductor with several orchestras, including school orchestras. Once, I walked into a room full of white middle school kids. I expected their stares. Until I stepped onto the podium, they thought I was there to move equipment. When I asked one of the players to lend me her violin so I could demonstrate how I wanted a passage played, silence ensued. Then, when I tucked the violin under my jaw and showed them what to do, the room let out a collective wow. No one had ever seen someone like me play something like that. It's not fair that people who look a certain way must constantly prove their worth, but at this juncture in history, we're well beyond what's fair. Even after almost 40 years of playing violin, I am still confronted with conscious and unconscious discrimination. If I'm playing Handel's Messiah, a piece that I perform probably 100 times on violin and viola, white directors often place a white person on my part because they don't think that I can handle it and my partner will be able to help me. I smile. Then, when my partner, who is usually much less experienced than I am, plays the piece less proficiently than it might be played, I offer advice. My partner is almost always grateful, and Handel's Messiah is the better for it. When I was younger, in high school and in college, I often wanted to give up until my Dr. Janice Stevens came into my life, offering pure and desperately needed encouragement. That kind of mentorship truly changed the direction of my life. And that kind of mentorship is what I try to offer my students today. Being a black man is great. I love who I am, but it's also a great responsibility, one that I take very seriously. As a teacher of young kids, I realized early on that for many of my students, I would be the first black man they actually meet in person. The impression I leave them with will hopefully stay with them for years to come. My speech, appearance, attitude, and demeanor are always professional because I know, like it or not, that I am representing a huge group of people. This doesn't mean that I alter myself to make anyone comfortable. I speak with my normal deep voice, I still rock my earrings, and if it's a hot day, my tattoos will still peek out from under my shirt sleeves. Who you are goes far beyond what you look like. My hope is that Ray's story will inspire all of you, white or black, Asian or Native American, straight, gay, transgender, cisgender, blonde or dark-haired, tall or short, big feet or small, to do what you love. Inspire those around you to do what they love, too. It might just pay off. Alone, we are a solitary violin, a lonely flute, a trumpet singing in the dark. Together, we are a symphony.
This is J.D. Jackson. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Violin Conspiracy by Brendan Slocum. This program was directed by Joseph Grimm. Executive producer, Molly Loray. Edited by John Marshall Media. Text copyright 2022 by Brendan Slocum. Production copyright 2022 Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved. Thank you.